Hello everyone and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, content manager at the Institute, and in this podcast we will be looking at news from the week up to the 18th of November 2019. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Well, our first story, Kate, reminds us why investors must pay attention to their beneficiaries' governance. SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son gave a regretful press conference on recently to explain huge write-downs at his firm in the wake of damaging investment misfires. In particular, the event focused on his firm's backing of office-sharing hub WeWork, a company that was poised for a landmark initial public offering of shares back in September, only to dramatically shelve the initiative following weak market interest. Central to that collapse of enthusiasm were concerns over the leadership style of WeWork's flamboyant former CEO, Adam Neumann, who was ousted from his controlling position on the 24th of September, but kept the title of co-chairman. At the briefing, Masayoshi Son conceded, "My judgment around WeWork was not right in many ways. I turned a blind eye to Adam Neumann's bad side on things like corporate governance. I have learned a harsh lesson from my experience with Adam Neumann." Kate, looking at this story, what can investors do to prevent poor governance practices?
In a way, it's a shame that this has become about personalities and about Adam Neumann, because actually there shouldn't be poor and lax governance policies in place anyway. So the fact that somebody was able to take advantage of their non-existence was useful because it brought attention to how poor they are in the first place. So I think any investors, before they invest, it's a bit late after you've made the investment to then realize that the governance is poor. It's part of their due diligence before they make investments. And again, it's a reminder, we sometimes get so seduced by these characters who tend to be charismatic or credibly energetic or full of great ideas, and there becomes a distance around them. And maybe people are actually scared, frightened to say, no, that's wrong, or to rein them in. Whereas if you have good and robust policies, you're able to say, shame you can't do that, Adam, but our governance won't let us. And I think that is the difference. You won't have rogues, as it were, behaving badly, because you'll always have those procedures and policies to protect you and also them as individuals who have sort of lost sight of what they're in business for.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story looks at approaches to organisational values taken by video games giant Blizzard. Blizzard is currently undergoing a rift with its head office staff and also its global users community for apparently reneging on two of its core values. The trouble dates back to the aftermath of a professional e-gaming session in October, when the winner used a live-streamed post-games interview to call for democracy in his home city, Hong Kong. Shortly afterwards, Blizzard rescinded his prize money and suspended him from playing in the game's Grandmaster League for 1 year. The decision spawned outrage among e-gaming fans, many of whom highlighted the irony of this, given the values listed in Blizzard's online mission statement, which include "Every voice matters" and "Think globally." Kate, what does the experience of Blizzard suggest about how leaders must approach values?
Well, as our research published this week to coincide with International Leadership Week has revealed, many people go to work with personal values that don't actually align with those of the organisation. Is this because the organisation is, as it seems to us, a setting values without really including everybody in them, which is one sort of problem? So how do you own values in which you've had no part, as it were? But the really striking thing about this story is how once you've published your values, once you've put them on your website, you don't own them anymore. They are out there, and they are out there for you to be called out if you don't live them. And that amusing irony in this particular situation, where they're saying things that must sound really good in a boardroom or really look really great on the website, when it actually comes to living those values, it was a very, very different proposition. So you're in a way that you're hostages to fortune, aren't they? If you create values that you're not truly living, if you create values because they're part of a brand strategy and they're not about the daily lived experiences of everybody in the organisation, they will either be ignored or you'll come unstuck.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story looks at an idea that is currently receiving a lot of publicity in the UK, the four-day work week. An article by Korn Ferry notes that this is an idea that comes up often and then passes, but its time may have come following an experiment by Microsoft that gave its Japanese-based employees all the Fridays in August off while still paying them for 5 days. The results were eye-opening. Productivity, which the company measured as sales per employee, jumped 40% over August 2018. The article by Korn Ferry accepts that this is a one-month trial and it is limited, but Mark Royal, a senior director for Korn Ferry Advisory, says that in theory, the four-day work week could be a boon to the large number of employees who value flexibility for a variety of family-related reasons. The longer hours could also make getting work done across international boundaries a little easier. And also, for its part, Microsoft found that there were several non-people-related benefits too, including a 23% drop in electricity costs and a nearly 60% drop in the number of pages printed, and the firm intends to try a similar experiment this winter. Kate, do you agree with those who say that these workweek experiments are worth investigating, even though there are challenging questions that need to be answered?
As you say, this is so much in vogue and so much talked about, and in a way, it's just part of history. Working weeks decline over time and have continued to decline since industrialization. So, of course, we will be working less for fewer hours. Whether that will manifest itself as a four-day week, I think really depends very much in the sort of industry that you're working in. I think Mark Royal's point that somehow 4 days gives you more flexibility for family reasons seems a bit flawed to me, because if you're stretching your day, which might have been 9 to 5, from like 8 to 7, 4 days a week, that's less flexibility in lots of ways. And we're not thinking about those industries, those people who can't do 4 day weeks. What about retailing and hospitality? And the more people are free for the longer weekend, the more they're going to want to go out and consume recreation. And who's going to provide that? And often it's the lower paid people who are in those roles. And I would predict that rather than actually themselves reducing their workload to 4 days, even if paid for 5, they'll use that increased leisure time to take on additional work. But to me, the problem really with the 4 day week is, how sustainable is it? You can imagine how exciting it is if you're all working 5 days and all of a sudden there's an announcement, you only have to work 4, as long as you work harder, and we'll pay you for 5. Everybody would love that. Now, somebody joins the organisation when it's a 4 day week organisation. Do they have their excitement, that sense of gratitude, that wanting to go that extra mile because they feel that they've been rewarded? Probably not. They've taken on a 4 day week job. And to add to that, all the things that happen that are not output driven, that are not an agenda on a meeting, are the glue that keep the organisation going. They're the social aspects of work that are important to so many of us. And if we all come into work, heads down, get the job done so we can leave, how long is it before we start not knowing the people we work with?
Thank you very much, Kate. And actually, moving on from your comment about meetings and social aspects of work, our final story asks if meetings that conclude without any concrete decisions are actually useful episodes of organisational bonding. This is an opinion piece by Professor Patrick Hall on the website of Malmo University, in which he suggests that meetings should be seen as opportunities for participants to acquaint themselves with the organisation and understand who does what to bring the organisation together, or even to be a form of therapy, an opportunity to complain and be acknowledged by colleagues. Kate, this is perhaps a little counterintuitive, but is Professor Hall correct to say that decision-free meetings are okay as a form of organisational bonding or therapy?
I agree with Professor Hall. I've long been a fan of the maxim, don't listen to what people say, look at what they do. And the number of meetings that take place in organisations suggests to me that people actually like them, or there's something about them that's serving a vital purpose. It might be, as Professor Hall suggests, bonding and that opportunity just to talk, which is in stark contrast to the previous piece about the 4 day week, where opportunities to talk are being struck out of the organisational agenda. It's an opportunity opportunity to have informal conversations, to spark ideas, to actually get to know and like the people that you're working with, to see connections that you wouldn't see if you weren't at those meetings. So they are serving an essential purpose. And the idea that the only thing that happens in organisations is something that has an agenda item and has an action connected is really missing the point. And what is going on is people working together and trying to get a shared sense of meaning and trying to do a job that matters.
Thank you, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you very much, Rod.